I'm walking down the path in my garden, and I have a suggestion for you on how you could help with global warming. With a large lawn, I found a simple way of making a big difference. I sold my ride-on mower and bought a top-of-the-range Kress robotic lawnmower. It runs off rechargeable batteries and uses cutting-edge technology to mow and maintain a lawn this size. The petrol mower has gone, and with it, the emissions. I actually don't know why I didn't sell the ride-on sooner. With the Kress robotic lawnmower, the lawn is actually looking better. The tiny grass cuttings fall into the grass roots, helping to fertilize the grass. And the family doesn't have to put up with the noise and fumes from the ride-on. And I've freed up more of my time to spend with them and in the garden. It's an easy step. And you could also be making that change today. Ask for Kress in your local garden machinery dealer. Or visit kress.com.
There's a poem by the American writer E.E. Cummings called Injust, and it's about spring. And there's this line within it that describes this time as when the world is puddle wonderful. It's lovely, isn't it? This is a time of hope and activity. And really, it's my favourite time of year because it's now that both the garden and gardener really get going. So in this episode, we're trying to honour March in all its glory. You're listening to Gardening with the RHS with me, Guy Barter. Today, we'll be exploring how to build harmonious and colourful borders and turning back the clock to honour a few of the women who shaped the RHS. But first, it's prime tomato sowing season, so we thought it the perfect time to explore exciting varieties that thrive in a UK environment and are resistant to the bane of my existence, potato late blight. Simon Crawford has worked in plant breeding throughout his life, most recently as managing director of the Burpee Company. He's now retired, but retains his passion for the latest in the world of tomato breeding. So who better to turn to than this tomato aficionado?
Well, I started work for a small UK seed company in the early 80s. And as a result of that, I became involved in a number of projects, tomatoes being one of them, and a major part of my time was spent with that. And I came to appreciate the diversity and interest in this very much loved global fruit. Probably the most stimulation I received was the result of a Marks and Spencer project that I got involved with in the early 1980s. At the time, there was much discussion about the bags of water scandal in Germany. In other words, the Germans were up in arms about being shipped tasteless red bags of what they said tasted of nothing. And they were probably right. So Marks and Spencer at the time decided they would invest some money in developing a fruit, or continuing to develop Gardener's Delight as a commercial variety, which was the variety they were using at the time, and looking at other varieties to improve flavour. And it was that involvement with growers in Lancashire and Wye College, as it was then in Kent, which really inspired me to see the potential for improvement. You know, what the commercial companies were doing at the time versus what the consumer was looking for and what the gardener was looking for as well. So that's what really spurred me on, and the realisation that there's so much untapped potential still. Yeah, when it comes to colour, flavour and taste in tomato, there are very, very many different possibilities. We still, I think, underestimate the potential for colour in tomato, but there are more colours available now, both to the home gardener and through retailers and supermarkets. Yellow, orange, stripes, brown, white is also possible, green ripe is possible, and all of these add to a tremendous visual extravaganza, particularly from a culinary point of view. The elements of taste are really down to basically acids and sugars. The cherry tomatoes tend to have generally higher levels of sugar, but they can also have a nice acid tang to them. And I think getting that balance right is critical. But again, the complex flavour of tomato is the subject of other volatiles as well. So you have things like this umami flavour, a slightly spicy flavour in some fruit. You know, it's particularly true of some of the Japanese varieties like Momotaro, where you have another element as well as the sugars and the acidity. The other aspect is texture. And I think some people prefer a firmer tomato with a little bit of bite to it. Others prefer something that's softer. So, for example, some of the newer plum varieties, like Negina, which is also sold as Crimson Plum, is very, very firm. There's a new variety of cherry tomato that's being sold at the moment called Rubylicious. That's a variety that has, again, fairly firm fruit, so not too soft. In beefsteak types also, you know, sometimes the older varieties can be very soft. A new variety that's appeared in the last 3, 4, 5 years is a variety called Burlesque, which is a very large fruit, but still quite firm. So you can slice it easily into fairly thin slices and put it onto the plate in a ring, if you like, without it falling apart. Growing in the UK, you have two real choices, either to grow inside in the greenhouse or polythene tunnel, which is relatively straightforward. Choosing the right growing media, if you're using an artificial growing media or a grow bag or something like that, ensuring that you feed early is critical today, particularly with the peat-free media that we are now all using, because these media can run out of food. Growing in the soil is a lot easier, and it's a lot easier with watering as well. Outside, you have a choice of growing in the soil or growing in containers. But one of the major problems of the last 30 or so years growing tomatoes outside has been blight. It usually occurs, or only occurs, when we've had long periods of warm, wet weather. And as with the climate change we're seeing, the preponderance of blight is increasing. And we do put that down to climate change. So first of all, you will see blackened lesions on the leaves. These spread very rapidly in warm weather, usually resulting in total loss of the leaves. They completely die back. And then on some varieties, not all, but some varieties, that blackening spreads to the fruit as it ripens. And so you also get serious black lesions on the fruits of the tomatoes. And looking for blight-resistant tomatoes is an essential part of planning for growing outdoors. And resistant, please note, doesn't mean immune. It means that you may get some disease on the leaves and possibly on the fruit, but hopefully the progress of the disease will be limited by the genetic background of the plant. So choosing a cordon type, there are some pretty good varieties now that are available in different fruit sizes. So things like Toddler for a cherry, Cocktail Crush for a moneymaker style of fruit, Crimson Crush or Oh Happy Day for something slightly larger, and the new variety that's just been released, Rubylicious, also very, very good blight-resistant cherry. Bush varieties for containers, patio pots, it's also important to try to find some resistance in those types, but it isn't as easy as in the cordon indeterminate types. So choosing something like Veranda Red, for example, that does have some resistance, Lassetto, Lozano, Romello, all of those varieties have some resistance, although those varieties are quite vigorous, they need a larger pot. Summer Last is a variety that tends to ripen late, but does have very good resistance. So there are some choices out there. So again, it's worth trailing through the seed catalogues to see what is available.
Thanks there to Simon. Tomatoes that are resistant, or at least tolerant, of potato late blight are fantastically useful for people who want to grow tomatoes outdoors on allotments, for example. I use them all the time. And my favourites were two that Simon mentioned, Crimson Crush for standard-sized tomatoes, it's got good flavour, and Burlesque, it isn't quite so well-flavoured, but it's the beefsteak he was mentioning, it's nice and juicy and can be sliced. Some tomatoes are more resistant than others, and the bush ones I find are not terribly resistant, so I don't grow them. We get a lot of blight in this district. The blight disease affects both tomatoes and potatoes because they're very closely related. And this organism, which is fungus-like rather than a true fungus, thrives in wet weather. And in recent years, we've had quite a lot of wet summers. All we need is a downpour in warm weather in July and August, and the blight strikes. As Simon mentioned, one of the hugely exciting elements of tomatoes is the wide array of bright colours available today, colours that can add interest to both the allotment and the plate. And as we start thinking through all the ways we're renovating borders, beds and containers this year, I wanted to zero in on colour and how to pair plants with harmonious hues and textures in our gardens. So here, to share her philosophy on colour and how to build a border like a painter, Susie Paisley Tyler. Susie is the owner of Coton Manor, which is a past winner of the nation's favourite garden.
I'm lucky enough to live at Coton Manor, where the garden has been open now for 57 years, I think. And I've been running the gardening side of the garden for the last 33 years. And it's something I absolutely love doing. I never get bored. I suppose it's just a sort of endless challenge, which is always exciting. It's hard to describe, but you just get so involved in what you're doing, you forget every care that was bothering you when you were inside the house or lying in bed asleep or trying to sleep. And it just washes off you and you can completely absorb in what you're doing. And as I've got more experience with the garden and sort of got more focused on what I'm doing, I get more pleasure because I've developed a colour scheme for the different areas of the garden. And I can sort of see it working and improving every year to what I want. And just the joy of seeing plants growing, it's endless pleasure for me. I just think accidentally I sort of saw a connection initially in one border with two colours. There was Honesty, which is a deep sort of maybe pink colour in spring, which was scattered through the border. And there was this marvellous silver cardoon against which the Honesty was planted. And it was just a perfect combination. And so I picked up that colour and I started to use it for plants through the season. And I think what it taught me was that if you limit the colours in any one place, you develop a rhythm in the border. So it wasn't just that colour, it was some colours that were sympathetic with it, harmonious with it, blues and whites, and then foliage contrasting with the silver, so a bit of dark red as well as all the greens in the border. And it is this business of limiting and repeating colour which works. It also works with shapes as well on all sorts of different levels. One colour that is very popular with people who buy plants in our nursery is blue. Particularly women love blue. But actually blue is very good as a sort of companion colour. But if you have a border of just blue plants, it wouldn't look very interesting because it's quite recessive. And then it's a question of how much harmony and how much contrast you go for. So I would always err on the side of more harmony than contrast, because if you have too much contrast, it's a bit difficult for your eyes to take it in. Basically, the adjacent colours on the colour wheel are harmonious, and the opposite colours on the colour wheel will provide contrast. And that's sort of basic fact. And so, for example, in a border which we rather imaginatively call the blue and yellow border, I have a lot of blue and a lot of yellow, because yellow sets blue off and makes it more interesting by contrast, okay? Whereas on the rose bank, where most of the roses are in shades of deep pink down to soft pink and white, the companion planting there is probably in similar shades of that range of of pinks. So they're more harmonious colours. Starting a border from scratch is really hard, but if you are starting a border from scratch, you need to look at the surroundings. So whether you've got dark green in the form of a hedge or red brick in the form of a wall, and you've really got to take your cue from the surrounding materials. Most people are probably renovating a border with existing plants in it. So if you're in that situation, if you're trying to start renovating a border, you've got to look at the existing plants, and if there's some colours that particularly appeal to you, existing in the border and flowering in the border, so you can see what they're going to do, I would take my lead from one of those colours or more than one of those colours and be quite brutal about removing things that wouldn't look happy with a theme along those lines. It's not easy. A border is so complex to get right. In terms of what plants I would rely on for the border, I think in our case, and everybody's soil is so different that not everything behaves the same way in different circumstances, Campanula lactiflora, particularly if you can get the dark form Pritchard's variety, a wonderful blue, is an absolute standby in our garden. Helenium sahin's early flora is an orange herbaceous plant which flowers from July to October, so that's incredibly good value. Clematis heraclifolia cassandra is a stunning plant. It's scented and will also flower for 3 or 4 months. And probably one of the best is Aster fricatii munch, which again will flower for 4 months. One of the things I would say to people, and I've said it in my book, which people don't think about, is that when you plant a border, plant 1/3 with early stuff, most of which only flowers for 2 to 3 weeks, and plant 2/3 with stuff that flowers from July onwards, because that'll probably flower 2 to 3 months. And nobody sort of thinks about it, but it's true. And the point about the early part is that you've got such wonderful fresh foliage at that point. You don't need so much flower colour because the leaves do it for you. I think the maxim, less is more, is invaluable. And in a small space, it's even more important, because if you cram too many things in, the eyes become confused. Whereas if they can bounce along similar colours, it's quite soothing.
We've included a link to Susie's new book, Gardening with Colour at Coton Manor, in our show notes. One of the great joys of gardening is the opportunities for playing with colour. Sometimes it's on a very short scale. You plant bedding plants in pots and tubs in the spring and you mix and match your colours. And sometimes it's on a longer scale when you have herbaceous plants that might last 3, 4, 5, even longer in the garden. I must admit that I'm rather more interested in plants than I am in colour, and I probably don't spend as much time as I should mixing and matching colours in my garden. But I do find that you can soften the contrast and the clashes with lots of lovely greenery when you're planning your garden. My favourite colour is quite a difficult one. It's yellow. I do love a yellow rose or a yellow sunflower or a yellow coreopsis, and I like to mix those with a bit of pink and blue and lots of green. And finally, we're moving away from the more practical side of things and turning back in time to the early days of the RHS. In celebration of both International Women's Day and the 220th anniversary of the RHS, Fiona Davison, Head of Libraries and Exhibitions, is sharing the ways in which women have shaped the organisation throughout its history.
It always seems to have been that women have had to push to gain access to the RHS. You know, it took 20 years after the society was founded for its first female member to be allowed in, which was Lady Radnor, in 1824. So, you know, 20 whole years without a single woman. So, yeah, it seems like it's been hard fought. I'd say that was the trend. So I think the important thing is to realise that it wasn't that women weren't gardening or weren't, you know, kind of being involved in horticulture at a high level. It just hadn't occurred to the Horticultural Society of London, as we were to begin with, that women would want to join a society and want to, you know, present papers and present ideas and be involved in that kind of very gentleman's club kind of atmosphere that they built. But what changed gradually was an awareness that women did want to do that. They were gardening at a high level. They did want to understand the latest science and did want to try out new techniques and growing new plants. And they were just as keen and just as well informed as male gardeners. So the first openings are wealthy women with a keenness for horticulture who want to become fellows and kind of benefit from the society in the same footing as men. And being wealthy, they were well connected, they could afford the, you know, very high prices that the society originally charged. And gradually, over the first 100 years, I would say, of the society's existence, you see more women, but they're still very much the minority, but they're definitely increasing in presence. At first, the society seemed to think that the suitable role for these women fellows was to organise the charitable dinners and sort out the guest list and that kind of very lady style interaction. But over time, first 100 years, they begin to appear on committees and begin to, you know, win awards and win medals and things for their exhibits and operate on the same footing as men did. After this kind of gradual, you know, kind of involvement, there was still really a glass ceiling. Women were on committees and were winning medals, but council, which is the governing body of the RHS, even until the 1960s, completely male and had been from the beginning. And in fact, it took until, I think it was 1967, where a question was asked at an annual general meeting, why aren't there any women in council? And the response from our then president was so ham-fisted that it actually didn't calm things. It made it worse because he just said that, you know, well, being on council is awfully hard work. And, you know, you need to be very knowledgeable about horticulture. And the kind of implication from was that there weren't any women that were, which was clearly not the case. And there's an excellent letter in our archive that was published in the Times from Mrs. Madeleine Spitter, who kind of pointed out that if the RHS cared to look, they would find some hard-working, knowledgeable female gardeners out there and that council might benefit. And lo and behold, 1 year later, we get Frances Perry, who's our first female councillor, who was an expert in water gardening, incredibly well-known and well-respected gardener, and, you know, she broke through. So even with all these barriers and hurdles and the fact that, you know, it took till the late 60s to get a woman on council, even before that, clearly there were strong women and there were women who made a difference and could be said to shape the RHS. So the highest accolade that the RHS can give a gardener is the Victoria Medal of Honour. And the first issuing of that for Queen Victoria's, I think, Diamond Jubilee, included two really well-known women gardeners, and that's Ellen Wilmot and Gertrude Jekyll. And you'd be hard-pressed to find two people in that kind of generation who had a bigger impact on gardening taste and expectations about what a good garden looked like. And both very, very forceful figures. Ellen Wilmot actually on committees, RHS committees, but Gertrude Jekyll, her influence was through her writing and her publishing and the gardens she designed. But you also get, again, you know, before women broke into the council, you've got some notable women who worked for the RHS. Dr. E.K. Janaki Amal, who's our first female scientist, salaried paid female scientist. She's a cytologist, so that means she looks at genes, and she did gene mapping and some genetic manipulation of plants at Wisley. Groundbreaking, pioneering work, very, very important woman. She stayed with us for a few years at Wisley from 1947 to the early 50s, at a time when not only was gardening still, professional gardening still quite male, plant science was as well. So things are very different now, of course. We've had not only lots of women on council, we've had a woman president. Elizabeth Banks was our first female president. We've had three female director generals. And, you know, you look at the staff of the RHS, I think women are in the majority. It's a very, very different landscape altogether. The garden designer at Chelsea who's won the most medals is female. I think last year there was a landmark year in that for the first time ever, the majority of exhibitors were female for garden designers. So it's a big shift. You know, it's no longer a male preserve by any stretch of the imagination. I think there is still inequality within the sector as a whole. If you look at what I'd call kind of heritage gardens or public curated gardens, that's very even in terms of gender. There's very even male-female split in terms of head gardeners. But when you look at commercial horticulture and landscaping, that's still quite heavily male-dominated. And I published a book recently about early women female professional gardeners and been doing book events up and down the country, and literally without fail, at the end when it's questions or people come up to you at the end, without fail, a woman gardener, a professional woman gardener, will come up to me and she will tell me that she has had exactly the same kind of barriers and criticisms of, oh, women aren't strong enough, can't hack it, you're not a real gardener, had those comments that were made to the women I wrote about in the 1890s were made to them, you know, within 10, 20 years ago. And that's quite shocking, that kind of attitude that you're not a proper gardener if you're not a big burly man. There's still little echoes of it around. I think that actually remembering what women were able to do and kind of digging out the stories of what women were able to do in a much more disapproving and hostile environment kind of hopefully gives us hope that, you know, progress can still be made and much more rapidly.
Thanks there to Fiona Davison. Fiona wrote a fabulous book on women in horticulture called An Almost Impossible Thing. We've included a link in the show notes. Before we go, I wanted to share a few things I've been up to in the garden this week. When it hasn't been raining heavily, I've been getting the ground ready to start sowing my early crops, my carrots, for example, and my peas and my broad beans. And I've also been planting out broad beans that I raised in the greenhouse. And this is the great time for filling up the greenhouse and especially my heated propagator with little pots of seeds, ready to start all the vegetables and flowers that I'm going to be growing this year. And it's also time to feed the garden, applying fertiliser where I think it needs it. As I've been going round deadheading my bulbs, and I've also been feeding the bulbs that haven't flowered. Things like narcissi, we call them blind when they don't flower. So I fill a watering can with high potassium fertiliser and water each little clump. More impetuous gardeners would dig them up and replace them, but I just feel that's a bit cruel. And I've been taking cuttings as well, with little plants of nemesias and diaceas and chrysanthemums that have survived the winter. I've now gone with a sharp knife and started off cuttings and put them in my heated propagator. So I'm raising lots of plants for lots of colour this summer. Unlike last year, that was wonderfully dry in February, this February, and indeed the preceding autumn, has been very wet, and a lot of gardens are lying wet and soggy, and you just can't do anything with them. The soil is too wet and sticky to cultivate, and in fact, cultivating wet soil damages it. However, as soon as we get some drying winds in March, you'll be able to get out there, and for now, if you've got some planks, you can lay down planks on the wet ground and be able to access things like roses for pruning. And as soon as the surface has dried out, working from the planks, to spread your weight, you can start sowing and planting. That's all for now. So from me, Guy Barter, goodbye and thanks for listening.
I'm walking down the path in my garden and I have a suggestion for you on how you could help with global warming. With a large lawn, I found a simple way of making a big difference. I sold my ride-on mower and bought a top-of-the-range Kress robotic lawnmower. It runs off rechargeable batteries and uses cutting-edge technology to mow and maintain a lawn this size. The petrol mower has gone, and with it, the emissions. I actually don't know why I didn't sell the ride-on sooner. With the Kress robotic lawnmower, the lawn is actually looking better. The tiny grass cuttings fall into the grass roots, helping to fertilise the grass. And the family doesn't have to put up with the noise and fumes from the ride-on. And I've freed up more of my time to spend with them and in the garden. It's an easy step. And you could also be making that change today. Ask for Kress in your local garden machinery dealer. Or visit kress.com.
Discover the beauty of an RHS membership all year round. Save 25% off an RHS membership today when paying by direct debit. Prices start at just £55.50. With a membership, you'll gain access to an array of special events at our gardens all year round. Be the first to know about RHS flower shows and get exclusive member-only days, plus reduced-rate tickets. And you'll have the chance to enhance your gardening know-how with access to free expert garden advice, monthly editions of the Garden magazine, and so much more. Terms and conditions apply.